Because in this story, the young married couple are going on vacation to the Grand Canyon, and an iceberg comes floating down the Colorado. Global warming. It could happen. Well, this isn't the dystopian vacation rom-com you seem to be imagining. I just have cold feet. You married me for better or worse. Let me tuck my cold feet under your warm legs. She did so and continued. Anyway, Lindsay pulled him briefly aside and said something, and after that he behaved himself impeccably. I think you'd like him. Is he incredibly short? No, he looks like he does on screen. Pretty tall. Most actors were shorter than you'd think, Iris had discovered, with big heads and large features, and an overwhelming tendency to look at themselves in mirrors, windows, and other people's sunglasses. She had never been very comfortable with industry people, and largely kept away. But they did have some friends from Sarah's work, like Lindsay. How was your day? Sarah's feet were warming up, and her arms stole around Iris's waist and tugged her closer, rubbing her face into her neck, smelling the clothes soap they used, feeling secure and loved. She could give David Rapelli's gratitude a run for its money. Iris shrugged. It was good. Then she suddenly gasped and sat up. Oh my God, I can't believe I didn't tell you this as soon as you walked through the door. Anne Porter has been having an affair, and Charlie found out today and threw her out. They had a huge fight in the street. I saw the whole thing. It was awful. Sarah rolled away from her wife and sat up. No way. Way. Seriously? She was cheating? How long had that been going on? Sarah looked genuinely shocked and surprised. Iris shook her head. No idea. Frances said she saw it several months. How did Frances know that? She talked to Anne about it. She knew about it before Charlie did? Yeah, but only for a few days. Iris told Sarah the craft supplies slash infidelity story. Sarah sat there and gazed at her. Holy fucking shit! Those poor kids! What a disaster! Do you want more ice cream? Iris nodded. Sarah grabbed her bowl and headed downstairs. The dog followed her, and Iris sat in bed and listened to the two of them having a conversation. Or at least Sarah had a conversation, but Roscoe was apparently jotting his answers down on a pad, because Iris couldn't catch his responses at all. When Sarah came back, she had two bowls with her. One contained her own ice cream, which was vanilla and about the size of a walnut, and the other was for Iris, which had two flavors of ice cream, whipped cream and chocolate sauce. We're out of maraschino cherries, Sarah said as she helped Roscoe get up on the bed again. We weren't, but I gave Roscoe the last one. That explains his pink nose. Are maraschino cherries good for dogs? No idea. I give him them all the time, and he's never complained. You do? Yeah, that's why we're out. Anyway, tell me more about Anne and Charlie. What's going to happen? She sat down, still naked, put the bowl in her lap, screamed at the cold, got up, put on a t-shirt, and tried again. While watching this pantomime, Iris half-heartedly picked up her magazine, then put it down. I don't know, it just happened. I doubt they even know themselves. She looked at Sarah. Would you divorce me if I cheated on you? Sarah nodded. Of course, if I knew. If I didn't know, I'd be fine about it. She frowned. You're not cheating, are you? Of course not. Not that I'd tell you. Right. Sarah tipped her head on one side as she thought about it, a habit she had that impersonators often mocked. It was natural, though. She'd always done it. I guess it would also depend on what kind of cheating. Iris turned onto her side, facing her wife. How do you mean? Isn't there one basic kind, the kind where you sleep with someone you're not married to? Yeah, but there are so many variations on the theme. Please explain, Professor. Sarah sat up in bed and curled her legs under her, counting off on her fingers. 1. The Wham Bam Thank You Ma'am School of Cheating, where you hook up with strangers in bars, hotels, nightclubs, and simply have sex. No information is exchanged, no follow-up is expected or desired. Iris nodded. I've heard of this. Continue. 2. The kind that comes up on sets or on vacation or on temporary assignments of one kind or another. This kind is mostly about sex, but it's also about recreating the first few days or weeks of a new relationship. You're both slightly nauseous. You lose 10 pounds in as many days. You start wearing nicer underwear. Or no underwear. If you're that way inclined, and you flirt in front of other people and generally toy with the secrecy and excitement of illicit romance. However, it is always understood that this is a fling, nothing more. And although it can be passionate and personal and intimate, it is not intended to develop into anything. Okay, check. Iris was suddenly enjoying this conversation less. Sarah had clearly thought this through. 3rd, and this is where it starts to get sticky, is the kind that starts as one of the above, usually the latter, and then gets out of hand. This can happen any time to anyone, which is why infidelity is such a dumb idea if you love your spouse. 1 minute you're having a giggle with the wardrobe girl, and the next she's boiling your rabbit, if you get my reference. To Fatal Attraction? Yes, I get the reference. We don't have a rabbit, thankfully. True. And finally, you have the worst, or best, kind of infidelity. The one where you fall in love with someone else and your marriage ends. Is that always what happens? Your marriage ends? No. Sometimes you fall in love with someone else and are grown up about it and change jobs, or do something else so you don't see that person anymore. And never take it beyond the confines of your own head. Other times, you both know you're in trouble before you get into it, and you have a very sad conversation where you agree that if you lived in a different world, you'd be together. But you don't. See earlier reference to changing jobs. And other times, you acknowledge the attraction, have one very steamy makeout session, and end it there. Sarah suddenly sighed. But that choice is a very dangerous one in my experience, because once that physical bridge has been crossed, it tends to fall down behind you like a chase sequence in an action movie, and there's no going back. Iris looked at her wife, who wasn't even seeing her anymore. She cleared her throat. In your experience? Sarah looked up and correctly read Iris's expression. Not in my experience, but in my experience of other people's experiences. My knowledge of the world. And my extensive watching of movies and reading of books. Iris frowned. Are you sure? Her heart was curling at the edges, her palms suddenly sweaty. Sarah smiled at her. Yes, idiot. Besides, this is why I like it best when you and Wyatt come on location with me. Then I don't need to worry that you're screwing around with some other hot mom or delicious co-ed babysitter who wants to be taken in hand by a gorgeous older woman and shown the ropes. You watch too many movies. It's my job. Iris shook her head. Wyatt's going to be in middle school soon, and then it won't be so easy to take him out of school, you know. What then? What if you're on location for months and the starlet is irresistible? Well, get a tutor. This is L.A. Schools are used to it. This is because of Ann Porter, isn't it? Iris thought about the second baby she wanted so much. What would that do to her marriage? Sarah suddenly put both bowls of ice cream aside and straddled her wife. She pinned Iris's arms down as she kissed her. Why? Kiss. Would I? Kiss. Ever risk, kiss, kiss, losing 1 second of your happiness for hours of anything else. Kiss, kiss, kiss. Anytime I'm not actively doing something, anytime I'm not doing my work or driving a car or making a sandwich or anything, in fact, at all, I am thinking of you, of your face, your hands, your waist, your sweet, sweet smile. Sarah leaned closer and gently licked the end of Iris's nose. And your delicious, incredible nose. She let go of one of Iris's hands and slid her own down under the covers and started gathering the hem of Iris's nightie. My biggest problem with these ridiculous nightgowns is how long it takes to get them off. Later, as Sarah was drifting off to sleep, she muttered, "Plus, what if Anne had gotten pregnant? It could have been even more awful and complicated." She yawned, squeezing Iris's hand where it lay beside her on the quilt. "At least we can cheat secure in the knowledge that that particular outcome isn't going to catch us out." Her breathing slowed, her grasp loosened. Iris lay there in the dark, gazing up at the ceiling. Her heart suddenly constricted again. "Yeah," she said softly. "Lucky us." 22. When Frances got home from drop-off the next morning, Anne was sitting on her front step. "Can I talk to you?" She looked awful, cold and pinched, despite the typical warmth of the day. As Frances nodded and opened the door, she thought she saw Charlie coming out of his house up the street, but wasn't sure. She hoped not. She really didn't want to take sides. Well, apart from the side of the kids, that side she would always be on. The dogs greeted Anne in their usual enthusiastic fashion because A, they didn't know she was a cheater, and B, they're instant forgivers dogs. It's just the way they roll. They also sensed deep misery and followed her into the kitchen and sat next to her while she lowered herself into a chair. While Frances pulled the usual mugs from the cupboard and looked to see if there was any coffee left, Anne petted the dogs and felt like death warmed over. In the distance, Frances could hear the shower running. "Michael's still here, you know. Is that okay?" Anne was still petting the dogs as if it were going out of fashion. She nodded. "It doesn't matter. I just wanted to talk to you." She looked up suddenly. "Does he hate me?" "Michael?" Anne nodded, so Frances shook her head. "No, or at least he hasn't said so. It's not our place to hate you, is it? You didn't cheat on us." What she didn't say was that she and Michael hadn't spoken yet that morning, so who knew what he thought? She'd been giving him the cold shoulder, and had been a little vexed that his car was still out front when she got back from drop-off. She'd hoped he'd be forced to reach out to her from work, maybe send her flowers, or leave her apologetic voicemails. That way, she could nurse her resentment in solitude, whereas if she saw his face, she would find it hard to stay mad. Their relationship was basically a deep, deep friendship at this point, and flares of anger usually just fell into the darkness and burned out. They frequently ignored the advice to never go to bed angry, but it took too much effort to stay mad past the following lunchtime. Anne got a flush of color. "I'm not sure everyone will be as understanding as you two." Frances had started making a fresh pot of coffee and was reaching for filter papers as she answered. "I don't think it's understanding. You know how I felt about you cheating after the other day. But the fact that I was right, that it ended really badly, doesn't make me happy in the least. You know that. I wish I'd been wrong, because now things are all fucked up." Anne looked at her. "I don't know what's going on with me. I felt so lonely and empty, and suddenly Richard was there and he saw a totally different side of me, not even a side that I knew existed. I was a different person with him." Frances was leaning against the counter, listening to the gently puffing efforts of the coffee maker. She noticed the laundry was done and moved it over to the dryer, dumping the dry clothes into a basket. "Well, who are you now? Are you seeing a psychiatrist?" Anne frowned. "Do you think I should?" She kept crossing and recrossing her legs, and Frances wondered idly if she had a urinary tract infection. She said, "Well, let's look at the face of it, shall we? You just destroyed several lives, including your own, over a brief and meaningless relationship. You're mystified as to why you did it, and you find yourself adrift now, not sure how to get back to normal. I would think a psychiatrist might be helpful. You're depressed." Am I depressed? Or am I just responding appropriately to a disastrous situation? It wasn't disastrous until you made it that way. Go get help, Anne. The coffee maker was done. Usual? Anne nodded. Will you help me? I'm not a shrink. I'm not any kind of doctor, and you need professional help. She added half and half, hesitated as she tried to remember if Anne took sugar in her coffee or not, decided she could use the extra calories and added some. Anne was still talking. I mean with Charlie. Will you help me with Charlie? Frances carried over the coffee, then turned to get cookies. Did you have breakfast? Anne shook her head. Eggs? Anne shrugged, so Frances pulled out a pan, butter, and eggs. Food before anything, always. Her mother had always been a good cook, and after Frances's brother died, she became almost fanatical about it. Frances would eat 3 meals a day, under the watchful eye of her mother, because she knew it was 3 times a day her mother felt like maybe she had some control over the shitstorm that was life. If this child was fed, she seemed to radiate, then maybe she won't suddenly die. Frances had inherited this belief, and now she was making eggs for Anne because it was what she could do. Ava had once joked that on her mom's headstone it was going to say, "I'm fine, but when was the last time you ate something?" Frances cracked a couple of eggs while the butter melted, whisking them together with a fork, adding a pinch of pepper. "I don't honestly know what I can do for you, Anne. You need to fix this if you can. How are the kids?" Anne shrugged. "We told them together, because that was what Charlie thought we should do. But they seemed confused about it. I stayed and helped put them to bed. But then I left." "Are you staying at your parents'? They're in Santa Monica, right?" "Yes, but no. I haven't told them yet." Frances put a plate of eggs in front of her friend, and felt herself standing over her, just like her mom had always done. That was creepy, so she sat down. Anne ate, her usual color returning. "These are so good. Thanks." Frances smiled. "You have to take care of yourself. If you want to save your marriage, you're going to have to fight for it. You'll need your strength." "I don't think Charlie will forgive me." "Would you forgive him, if he'd been the one who cheated?" Anne shrugged, cleaning up the last of her eggs. "I have no idea." She looked at her neighbor. "Will you help me? Will you help me talk to Charlie?" Michael walked in, his hair still wet from the shower. He opened his mouth to speak to Frances, but paused when he saw Anne. 2 seconds passed, then he glided onward. His unflappability was one of the things Frances enjoyed about him.
"Hi, Anne. Sorry to hear things are all fucked up right now."
And his honesty. Frances enjoyed that, too. Anne blushed.
"Yeah. I messed up. Sorry."
Michael grabbed a travel mug from the cupboard and filled it with coffee.
"Don't say sorry to me, dude. No need. We all make mistakes."
He added cream, put on the lid, and said,
"Last night, for example, I behaved like a total dick to my lovely wife, who has punished me terribly by simply not smiling at me this morning."
He stood in front of Frances and added,
"I am such a phallus. I am so sorry. Please smile at me again so I can go on with my life."
Frances narrowed her eyes at him. So fucking annoying.
He would behave badly, but then apologize magnificently, so she would have to forgive him. She smiled a small smile, which broadened once he'd bent down and kissed her. "Go to work, total dick," she said, and he turned to leave. As the front door closed, Francis could smell her shampoo in the air. He bitched about her fancy Aveda shampoo that cost too much, but used it himself, the hypocritical swine. She felt a sudden swoon of gratitude that she wasn't in the same boat as Anne, that she and Michael were making it okay, despite hating each other from time to time, and not having enough sex, and not having much to talk about besides the kids. It wasn't a sexy marriage, it wasn't a fun-filled romantic romp, but it was solid. She felt a flicker of concern at the back of her mind that if a few glasses of wine were revealing Michael's real feelings about her, then maybe they were in more trouble than she realized. But she couldn't face thinking about that now. She had other people's lives to think of, and yes, she was aware of the irony of that. "I'll help you if I can, Anne," she said, reaching across the table for her friend's hand. "But I don't know what I can do." She paused, treading carefully. "Were there problems between you two before?" Before you started the affair." Anne looked out of the window, noticing how untidy Francis's backyard was, wondering why Francis had no standards at all. "No, things were fine. Just the same as ever. Richard just made me feel young again." She turned to Francis suddenly, her face flushing. "You know that feeling you had when you were 22 and you met someone and fell in lust and spent days and days in bed, fucking and talking and laughing and fucking, and it felt like there was only the two of you? It was like nothing I'd experienced for years. It was wonderful." Anne laid her head on the table and cried, her fingers curling around Francis's. "Okay," thought Francis. "Well, this I can do." She squeezed Anne's hand and sat there thinking about what her friend had said, and how scared she suddenly was that her husband felt that way about someone else. The store was called Please Come Again, and it was on Hollywood and Western. Francis had driven past it 1,000 times, idly reading the list of offerings. Bedroom toys, massage lotions, DVDs, fun bedroom wear. Every single time she read the list, she'd gotten an image of her husband on a scooter, naked, rolling gleefully across the bedroom with a jester hat on his head. She'd never seen this in real life, of course, but the combination of the words toys and fun bedroom wear met up in this way in her imagination. Clearly, her imagination was 9/10 of the problem. The lady inside the store was a middle-aged Latina with a friendly face and a surprisingly vanilla approach to sex. She liked it straight down the middle, missionary, with her husband and no one else. No need for anything more exotic than an extra Dos Equis on Friday nights. However, there was nothing she hadn't heard or seen in her 12 years in the store. And as she saw Frances walk in, she knew she could sell her a vibrator, a self-warming massage oil, and maybe, just maybe, a pair of fur-lined handcuffs. She further knew that Francis would maybe use the vibrator once or twice, the self-warming oil the next time she had a sore neck, and the fur-lined handcuffs never. Then she would ignore them in her bedside table for a year or two, until she suddenly realized the kids could find them and would struggle to think of a way to dispose of them without scaring the cleaning lady. She'd put it all in a paper bag and drop it in a trash can on the high street somewhere, thinking as she did so of the surprise of the next homeless person who'd hoped for a half-eaten sandwich, but ended up with so much more. But all this was in the future. Araceli was ready to focus on today.
"Good morning! How can I help you have better sex today?"
Francis was unable to stop a nervous giggle. "Does it have to be today?" Araceli nodded and smiled a smile that suggested they were talking about knitting rather than sex.
"It should be every day."
"Really?"
Francis felt tired suddenly.
Araceli nodded.
It is like any form of exercise. A little each day is better than a lot once a week.
She turned her attention to the cabinet she was resting on.
Can I show you some toys? A vibrator, perhaps? Pleasuring yourself is the first best step to pleasuring someone else.
Francis nearly bolted right then. The word pleasuring always made her laugh. She wasn't really sure why.
I guess so. Nothing to...
She stepped forward and looked through the glass lid.
Extreme.
There were things in the cabinet she could only hazard a guess at. Basic penis-shaped things she recognized. But there were also things with multiple ends and extra flaps and rib surfaces and bobbled surfaces and movable parts that would surely increase the risk of embarrassing hospital visits.
Well, I was walking along and I fell on it.
Yes, in a seated position, doctor.
How about this one? It's very popular.
Araceli held up a 7-inch silver bullet-looking vibrator, shiny and smooth.
It looks a little high-tech for me.
She also knew someone small would be using it as a lightsaber within 2 seconds of finding it, God forbid. Shit, where was she going to keep all this stuff?
Araceli reached for another. This one is maybe more familiar.
It was basically a realistic-looking penis.
Araceli turned it on, and it hummed in a friendly way.
Francis nodded, feeling she could get her head around that one, so to speak. She looked over at a rack of lingerie, and Araceli followed her gaze. Without the other woman noticing, she quickly scanned her figure, gauging what she had to work with, and stepped out from behind the counter.
Are you interested in something sexy to wear? We have many lovely things.
Francis could see nothing but string on hangers, but she gamely went with Araceli to take a look. Black and red featured prominently, although animal skin was also a common motif. She thought about the nature documentary she'd seen, and got sidetracked by images of baby pandas. Maybe she'd forgotten how to be sexy. She had been sexy as a younger woman, sexy and free and uninhibited. She'd had many lovers before Michael, and felt pretty good and liberated about the whole thing. But she'd also felt anxious and slightly crazy and out of control, and the safety and warmth of her relationship with Michael had felt like a safe harbor, not a dry dock. And then came the kids, adorable little passion killers each and every one. Araceli was holding up a black item that seemed to be constructed of 3 lacy doilies held together with bootlaces. She thought about looking at herself in the mirror, the doilies gamely holding on for dear life, the bootlaces disappearing into her little folds and curves, and shook her head.
My husband prefers me naked, she said, without thinking, and then started giggling uncontrollably.
It made her sound like some acolyte, and Michael stood tall in her mind, ordering her washed and brought to his tent. She lost it completely. Araceli waited patiently, shifting her weight from one foot to the other, thinking about what to make for dinner. Once Francis calmed down, she paid for the vibrator, some warm massage lotion, and a pair of fur-lined handcuffs, which she'd thrown in completely on impulse. If Araceli had been surprised by the choice, she certainly hadn't shown it. That afternoon, Frances called her mother, amazed at herself for thinking of it, and further amazed that she thought of it at a time when she had access to a phone and time to place a call. The kitchen was empty, the dogs were outside, the washer and dryer were both humming. There were flowers on the counter, sex toys in the bedside table. She was on top of her game, and nothing bad was going to happen to her. Her mother answered the phone, thousands of miles away in New York.
Frances said, "Hey, it's me."
She pulled her cup of tea closer, listening for the children. Normally, the best way to get them all to appear was to try and place an important phone call. They would then instantly materialize, often in tears, and always with demands of some sort. It was a kind of magic. Shitbird magic, but effective.
"Hi there, sweetheart. How are you doing? What's new in your neck of the woods?"
Her mother sounded just the same as always, the cadences of her voice familiar on a cellular level. Frances loved her mother dearly, and also felt very sorry for her, which hadn't been that great a combination when she was a teenager, but worked now, more or less.
"Nothing much. I heard your neighbor has been sleeping around. Is that such a normal occurrence it's not worth mentioning?"
Her mother laughed, and Frances heard the click of a kettle being turned on. She could see the kettle in her mind, see the kitchen counters with their countless red jars and mugs, a little color being what her mother loved. Anything red made her very easy to shop for.
"How on earth do you know that?"
Frances took a sip of tea, debated whether she wanted a cookie enough to get up for it.
"Ava told me."
Frances was surprised.
"When did you speak to Ava?"
Her mother laughed again. Clearly she was in a good mood. Or maybe she was as high as a kite, who knew?
"Yesterday. We talk on Skype, you know. You should look into this internet thing. I think it's going to catch on."
"Funny. That's nice. I hadn't realized you two were in touch so much." Her tea was sweet enough without a cookie.
"It's not that much. Maybe once or twice a week. She likes to talk. I like to listen. It's good."
Her mom sighed suddenly.
"I wish I'd listened to you more when you were her age. I have no memories of that time at all. I'm sorry."
Frances raised her eyebrows.
"That's okay, Mom.
It was a hard time, right? Because of Alex. I don't know how you kept going, honestly."
"Is that why you called?"
"What?"
"Tomorrow is the anniversary, you know. I thought maybe that was what you were calling about."
Frances got up and grabbed the cookie jar, which was shaped like an elephant.
"No, or at least I don't think so. Maybe on some level I remembered, but I just wanted to hear your voice." "He'd be the same age as Michael, you know."
She bit into a cookie, which truly was delicious.
"Yeah, I know. Their birthdays are even close." "Little May babies, both Taurus, strong and calm. I think about Alex all the time. Do you?"
A second cookie.
"I do. I think about what a great uncle he would have been. I think about the cousins the kids might have had, the nieces and nephews, the grandkids. Of course, he might have married someone we didn't like. There's always that chance. Like that girl across the street. Isabel. She ended up marrying a proctologist from Long Island."
"Serves her right.
Who knows? Maybe she and Alex would have been happy together. When you lose a child, you lose the life they would have had too. Right? Don't you look at the kids and wonder what kind of adults they're going to be? Who they're going to marry? That kind of thing."
Her mother's voice faded in and out as she bustled around her kitchen, all those miles away. Frances laughed ruefully.
"Mostly I just try to make it through the day alive. But sure, sometimes I think about the future. Mostly trying to imagine what life will be like once they've moved out and I finally have enough storage space."
Her mom sighed.
"I used to pretend Alex was just away, you know? Sometimes when it would get too hard, I would just decide he was at camp, and I would write him letters in my head, or imagine him climbing on ropes and riding horses and having a wonderful time. I would tell myself it was good I hadn't heard from him in so long. It meant he was busy and happy."
"Wow, that sounds delusional and painful." Would a third cookie lead directly to diabetes, or was it okay?
"Yeah," replied her mother dryly. "I think it's generally understood that outliving your child is horrible."
And now?
Still horrible, but bearable, because time really does, as they say, heal all wounds. It's also easier because none of my friends have kids at home either. The first few years it hurt so much because of this constantly nagging sense I was forgetting something. Then I'd remember he was gone and there was nothing I could do. And the other mothers in his grade knew it too. And I knew that every time they saw me dropping you off, they remembered Alex and felt sorry for me and guilty for being glad it was me and not them. Did you ever have those dreams where you forget you have a child?
Frances shuddered. Oh my God, not as much as I used to, but when the kids were babies, I'd have them all the time.
I'd dream I'd left the car seat on top of the car and driven off, or that I'd forgotten they existed and they'd been at home for days without anyone feeding them, and I'd rush home and they'd be crying and dirty and hungry, or not there at all because someone had taken them away from me. It was horrible. I still get them from time to time, but not so much.
Well, it was like that, but I was awake. That pit of the stomach panic feeling combined with a terrible physical pain and emptiness. I'd forget for a second or two, then it would come slamming back and knock the wind out of me. Your father and I didn't talk about him for nearly a decade. I think we each thought it would kill the other, just the act of physically shaping his name with our mouths.
How is Dad?
Her mom laughed.
He's addicted to meth and having an affair with a 40-year-old.
No, you're joking.
Yes, I'm joking.
He's fine. He's working on a book. He's teaching. He's happy. He has a cough that won't go away, and in the middle of the night I think it's cancer, but hopefully not.
Has he seen a doctor?
No, he just tells me not to worry, so I don't.
Lally came in, wearing a swimsuit and bunny ears.
Who are you talking to?
Grandma.
Lally took the phone.
Hey, Grandma. Did you watch the show?
A pause.
No, just her.
Another pause.
Yes, but...
And another.
I don't know.
Lally handed the phone back to her mother and rolled her eyes.
Grandma doesn't get Littlest Pet Shop.
She walked away, then stopped.
Can I have some chocolate milk?
Frances nodded and pointed to the fridge. Lally wandered over and hung on the big door with all her weight. It suddenly swung open, nearly knocking her over. Never not funny. Frances started to ask about the swimsuit, but remembered in time there was no point. She turned back to the phone.
What don't you get about Littlest Pet Shop?
So many things, her mother replied.
Why would someone leave a chameleon at a pet boarding service? Do all those animals belong to people who've just abandoned them? Do they have lives outside the pet shop? Is Blythe the only one who can talk to them? And why is her head so big? Who looks after her while her dad is away flying airplanes? Is the old lady who runs the shop on drugs? Why do those rich twins who are so funny go to a public school and not a fancy private one?
Wow, you do have a lot of questions.
I had no idea.
Don't you watch it?
Not if I can help it. However, I like the idea of you sitting in your nice Riverside Drive apartment watching Littlest Pet Shop taking notes.
Her mother laughed.
I like to talk to Lally about these things, although she was no help just then.
Frances's mind jumped back. So, tomorrow is 30 years? Is that possible?
Not only possible, but inevitable.
Is it hard every year?
Yes.
It doesn't get easier?
Yes, it's easier. But if something starts out as the most difficult thing in the world and then gets progressively easier each year, it's still pretty hard at the end, right?
I guess so. I hope I never find out.
Me too.
I'm so sorry, Mom. Frances drank her tea and watched Jack the dog rolling in a patch of sunlight in the garden.
Hopefully it was just sunlight. I see him in Milo, you know? Milo has his hair and his ears. He does? Send me a picture. There was a murmuring in the background. Your dad is here. Do you want to say hi? More murmuring. No, wait. He says we have to go. We have tickets to something. Okay, Mom, I love you. I love you too, Francis. Kiss everyone for me. I will. She hung up and sat and looked at the phone until Ava came in and asked about dinner. She surprised her daughter by pulling her onto her lap and hugging her very tightly. After a moment, Ava relaxed, and for a blissful minute they just sat there together. Then they parted, and Francis stood to get dinner ready. 23. It was late, easily past 10, as Charlie walked slowly upstairs to bed. He paused, hearing a noise. Then he turned at the top of the stairs and went into Theo's room. Daddy? Charlie sat on his son's bed, his weight tipping the child slightly toward him. Theo completed the small fall, curling around his dad and resting his head near Charlie's legs. In public, this boy was slightly standoffish, but in private, he had always been a cuddle bug. Charlie rested his hand on Theo's head, smoothing back his hair.
Yes, buddy. Can't you sleep? It's really late, and you have school in the morning.
I know. Such a small voice.
What's up?
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
You promise you won't get mad?
Charlie nodded and meant it.
I promise. Ask whatever you like, but then you should go to sleep.
The little boy nodded. A beam of moonlight slid through a gap in his dinosaur curtains and illuminated one ear. Charlie looked at where he assumed his son's eyes were, trying not to notice the similarity between Theo's ear and his mom's.
Why isn't Mom living here anymore? What really happened? Someone at school said she cheated on you.
Who said that?
I don't remember, lied Theo. Charlie sighed.
Well, I'm afraid that's kind of true. Your mom met someone else she liked more than me.
There was a silence.
I don't know what you mean.
Charlie shrugged.
It's hard to explain, Chief. You know when you've had a toy a very long time, and you get something new? For a while, that new toy is so much better than the old one, right? It's exciting, it's shiny, it does new things.
He trailed off, wondering if Richard had done new things with Anne, things he'd never tried. Maybe he had new jokes, maybe he went to the gym more, or at all. Maybe he loved different things about her than Charlie had loved. Still loved. Theo wasn't satisfied.
Yeah, I get that. But some toys are so good you never stop liking them, right?
Like?
Like Rotten Corner.
Rotten Corner was the name he'd given a piece of baby blanket he'd carried around since he was a toddler.
Does your blankie have a name?
Annette asked, as he'd sat on her lap, sucking his thumb and curling and uncurling the piece of baby blanket, its blue and red stripes still bright from the hospital. He told her it was called Rotten Corner, two words she'd had no idea he even knew, and clearly the name had stuck. Now RC, as it was more familiarly known, was a pale piece of blanket about a foot square, all the color washed out. But the magic still intact. It was folded under Theo's pillow now, just in case.
Yeah, some things are like that.
You're like that for me, Dad.
Theo reached as far as he could around his father and moved his head onto his dad's lap.
I won't ever want a newer dad.
Charlie felt his throat tighten. What if Anne ended up marrying this asshole? What if he tried to be a dad to Charlie's kids? For a moment he felt lightheaded with a mix of anger and fear. Then he unclenched his fist and spoke softly.
Buddy, No one could love you and your sister more than I do. And your mom loves you both just as much as she ever did. The problems we're having are between us, just grown-up stuff. It doesn't mean anything about you guys, okay?
Theo turned his head and looked up at his father. The moonbeam was now falling on the back of his neck, and Charlie could see the bones of his upper spine sticking up against his pajama top.
If she loves us so much,
he said in a voice as pale as a whisper,
she wouldn't want to play with anyone else. We'd be like Rotten Corner, the best forever. The best because it's old, not new.
He started to cry a little and tried to cover it up, pushing his voice through the lump in his throat so he'd seem tougher than his dad might think.
A new one might be shiny, but it wouldn't know anything. RC knows everything about me. It's been everywhere. Why doesn't Mom care about that?
His hand tightened on Charlie's leg.
Is she going to have new kids, too?
From down the hall, Kate cried out, and Charlie was saved from answering a question he didn't have an answer to.
Let me go see what's up with Kate, okay? I'll come back in a minute.
Theo watched his father go and reached under his pillow. Kate had had a bad dream and wanted to sleep with Charlie. He picked her up, her head already lolling on his shoulder, and carried her into his bedroom. He had no idea night times were so active in the house. He'd always been the one who slept through. After placing her on Anne's side and covering her up, he sighed and went back to Theo's room. His son was sleeping too, his cheek pressed against the damp piece of blanket he loved so much. Charlie went back to bed and lay there for an hour or two, wondering if Anne was going to have new children. 24. AYSO, which stood for something Francis could never accurately remember, and which was also described as Pee Wee Soccer, was Francis's least favorite thing in the world. She also felt pretty strongly about eggplant, but she fucking hated little kids soccer. It started in the fall, which in L.A. is still really hot, and involved several painful rites of passage. When she and Michael had been considering a third child, she had said out loud, "No, wait, we'd have to do soccer again." For some reason, it was a blight that hit every family hard. It started with the application form, which was only slightly less detailed than the forms for getting into one of the city's charter schools, which were currently heading the field in forms that are complicated beyond belief. Then there was the day, which started at some ungodly hour like 7 on a Saturday, when the teams got picked. You'd see groups of experienced parents herding their kids together as swiftly as greyhounds rounding a track corner, while other, less experienced parents ended up wandering around with wobbly-chinned kids looking for a group that had room. Shockingly painful, especially when your kid ended up in a little clump of other kids whose parents didn't understand the process. It was the sporting version of the Island of Misfit Toys, and if you think 5-year-olds haven't seen that movie, you're drunk. Then there was team parent and snack mom and volunteer coach, all positions that went to parents who'd just gotten off the turnip truck, soccerly speaking. She personally hated team parent, but coach was also a disaster. She'd seen world-famous directors in bright jerseys made of non-breathing material, reduced almost to tears by the challenge of getting a dozen 6-year-old boys to run in the same direction. Get 1,000 horses to come over a hill at once, sure. Get precious actors to emote on cue, no problem. Wrangle a set of producers who don't understand the importance of using real butterflies, damn the cost, all in a day's work. But stand in the blazing October sunshine, getting Tarquin, Samson, Argo, and Arrow, twins, to stop kicking the ball at one another's heads. Impossible. Snack parents sucked ass, too. She once saw a mom who published a well-known mommy blog about finding the joy in every moment, handing out Tic Tacs from the bottom of her purse as the post-game snack. Thank God the bottle of Xanax was in her other bag. On this Saturday, Francis had drawn the short straw because Michael had some work thing he needed to do.
She was marginally bitter as she stood on the sidelines, being grateful she wasn't Snack Mom this time, when she heard her name being called. She turned and smiled, while inside her head she said, "Fuck, fuck, fuckity fuck." She braced herself. Shelley was a mom in Milo's class, and Frances hated and feared her in equal measure. She was a cool mom on the surface. Casual shoes that cost a fortune, leggings on toned legs under vintage caftans, jewelry personalized with her many children's names, a commitment to veganism and alternative medicine, a firm belief in the joy of a childhood lived free of electronics and sugar, and a tendency to gossip about other parents with the rapier knife of a trained assassin. She specialized in concern, and as she got closer, Frances could see the small eyebrow furrow that indicated she was about to ask about Ann Porter. "Frances, how are you?" Shelley cooed, embracing Frances, and as always making her feel momentarily guilty for doubting this woman's good intentions. "How are the kids?" She turned and looked at Lally, who was running in the wrong direction, but grinning like an idiot. "Lally looks like she's having a good time." She kept watching as the referee came over and turned Lally around, sending her heading in the right direction without apparently realizing she'd been turned. "And that's all that matters, really, right?" "Of course," said Frances, correctly reading the implied comment on Lally's lack of athletic coordination. Shelley's kids were naturally good at lots of things, which, to be fair, was hardly their fault. Otter and Persimmon, both girls, and Jin and Arable, boys. Shelley liked to question gender-normative naming conventions because, as she had memorably put it at one early birthday party, names carry such weight in our society. Frances often wondered how much weight being named after a water mammal, a fruit, a clear alcohol, and a farming term carried. But as the kids themselves were very nice and easygoing, she'd never posed the question. "I heard the news about Ann Porter. It's terrible." Shelley looked at the ground, almost conjuring a tear, and radiating genuine concern. She looked up in time to catch Frances's raised eyebrow and added, "Not that I know her very well, of course. Not like you." Frances wondered if Shelley was suggesting that Frances was somehow complicit in Anne's cheating, but decided to give her the benefit of the doubt. "Yes, it's sad. I hope they're able to work it out." "For the children." "Sure, but also for them. I imagine divorcing someone is very painful, even if you're both ready to leave the marriage."
"And Charlie presumably isn't ready, seeing as he wasn't the one cheating."
Frances shrugged. "You'd have to ask him. I'm trying to stay out of their business."
"How do the kids seem?"
Frances nodded her head at a distant field. "Theo's playing goal and hasn't let any in yet, so he's presumably fine right now. Kate is sitting with her dad over there doing stickers. I expect they're sad, but they'll be okay. Kids are resilient, right?"
Shelley looked at her and tipped her head to one side. "You know, Frances, you don't need to be defensive. Friends rally around at times of crisis. It takes a village, right?"
She smiled sweetly.
"It's interesting when other people's pain brings up issues. Are you and Michael having problems?"
Frances resisted the urge to punch the other woman in the throat. "I didn't think I was being defensive, Shelley. I'm sorry if I gave you that impression." She felt herself starting to sweat, hating any kind of conflict. "If you're so worried about the Porters, you should go and speak to Charlie. He's right there." She wasn't even going to touch the comment about her own marriage. She herself never felt she was intimate enough with someone to ask about their marriage, unless they were, like, friends for a decade or related by blood or thrown together on a sinking cruise liner or something. You came across this false, fast intimacy all the time in the circle she moved in. People who loved to talk about their feelings, their fears, their colonic irrigation, their therapy, their children's therapy, their sex life, their new car. Frances barely had room in her head for her own feelings, plus a running grocery list. She felt like the Mad Hatter. No room, no room! She looked around, hoping the soccer game was nearly over, or that Lally had been mildly concussed or something that would end this stupid conversation. But no, Lally was now running in a different direction, still wrong, but different. Over on a nearby pitch, Milo was playing a real game of soccer. As the difference between 4 and 10 years old was significant when it came to rules and balls. Ava had loved soccer. Frances suddenly had a vision of the little trophy she used to bring home proudly, the slices of orange making her wrists sticky, the bouncing ponytail as she pelted across the grass. That 9-year-old was long gone now, and Ava seemed to barely remember her, or even care about the things that used to matter so much. Dinosaurs, doll clothes, horses, Legos. Drawing was the only one that stayed. The one passion that had yet to wane. Frances? Shelley was still looking at her, a deeper wrinkle between her eyebrows. Shit. Apparently she'd drifted off there for a moment. She looked at Shelley and smiled vaguely. Sorry, Shelley. Got distracted. What were you saying? But Shelley herself was suddenly distracted by something behind Frances, and the way her eyes widened suggested it was way more interesting than Frances's apparent descent into dementia. Frances turned, guessing before she saw her that Anne Porter had just arrived. Anne realized as she got closer that this was a major mistake, but she had told Charlie she would show up, and there was no turning back. She couldn't have chosen a more public place to appear, as pretty much everyone she knew was there, or at least enough of them that everyone she knew would get a first-hand account. She felt like crap. Apart from the eggs at Frances's, she'd barely eaten in the last few days. She still hadn't called her parents. Her mother didn't enjoy bad news. Or maybe she did enjoy it, but whoever brought the bad news lived to regret it. Anne decided to wait until she had a better story to tell. Rather than, "Hi, Mom, I fucked up massively and now my life has shattered into a million pieces," she wanted to be able to lead with, "Hi, Mom, Charlie and I have been having some problems, but it's all better now. How are you?" It might take a while, but she was going to wait for that. Her mom preferred to parent the good parts of her children only. Now Anne was standing in the heat of the soccer fields in the park, looking around for her kids, and trying very hard not to make eye contact with the parent body of her school. It was hard, because although a generous third of them were doing her the courtesy of pretending she wasn't there, the other two-thirds were avidly watching and hoping she was either drunk or insane. Some of them were looking behind her, hoping she'd brought the 18-year-old she was supposedly sleeping with. Suddenly she saw Frances and instinctively started walking toward her. Frances was looking at her, but with a question in her eyes rather than judgment. "Are you okay?" Anne walked toward her resolutely, avoiding any other eye contact. As she got closer, though, she realized Shelley was standing with Frances and nearly stopped. Shelley was absolutely the worst possible person to run into. But fortunately, Frances was stepping around her and walking to meet Anne in the middle, curving her body as she walked to suggest a bench off to one side as a meeting point. It was like semaphore. "Don't panic. We're heading for that bench. We're going to make it. Keep going." Anne had started to feel tingling in her hands and pulsing nausea. She was going to have a panic attack. "You're fine," was the first thing Frances said as they got close enough to hear each other. "You're fine. Just sit down on the bench. I'll get out the taser and keep the bitches at bay, okay?"
"Okay."
Anne's voice was a whisper. They were now walking together, and Frances added, "Lily's here somewhere, and so are Jim and Andy. And between us, we will create a human shield if we have to." They reached the bench and sat down. Anne was breathing rapidly, her color very bad, her nausea worsening. I'm going to throw up.
Frances shifted her purse on her shoulder and let it fall to the ground. Oh, dear, I dropped my purse. Quick, bend down.